This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another.
Hello, and welcome back to Practical for Your Practice. Or I guess if this is your first time listening and this is the first episode you've tuned in for, welcome. I am Dr. Jenna Ermold. I am one of the hosts of this podcast, and I am joined with my fabulous co-host, Dr. Kevin Holloway. How's it going today, Kevin?
It's going all right, Jenna. I'm excited for our episode today.
I'm always fired up for these, as you know.
Yes.
But I'm especially fired up today because we have made what I would consider like a colleague bestie, if that exists.
Yes.
And one of our colleague besties from the Uniformed Services University, Dr. Abby Deal, Major Deal, she is a major deal in our life, is joining us today. We're going to start with that pun, Abby. It can only get better from there. Welcome to the podcast. And if you could tell our listeners who you are and a little snapshot of what you do, that would be great.
Thanks, Jenna. I'm so excited to be here with you and Kevin and to do this. And the besties, colleagues, definitely.
Yes.
100% agree. I am Dr. Abby Deal. I'm a clinical health psychologist at the Uniformed Services University, and I work in the medical and clinical psychology department, but I have so many different hats that I wear. And it's really interesting because we were just like doing performance reviews and looking through all the things that we do. And I'm like, what even is my title? Like, what does this mean? Like, what do I actually do on a daily basis? So
I wonder if any of our listeners feel that too, right?
All the time. It's like, what am I doing today? Like, what hashtag costume relatable am I wearing today? Yeah. Am I being therapist Abby today? Am I being assistant professor Abby today? Am I being supervisor Abby today? Am I like being military leader Abby today? Like what am I doing?
Bestie colleague Abby today.
Right.
That's a full-time
right,
job.
Right. Am I doing my motivational interviewing training, which I love, like my honorary CDP job?
So for our listeners, just so you know what we're talking about, Abby is our instructor when we offer a motivational interviewing skills workshop here at CDP. And Jenna and I have the honor of, we get to hang out with her while she teaches. Like, I don't know that we contribute much, but we're there. And
we're
in the background, have fun conversations. And, you know, so this is our opportunity to continue to hang out with Abby where there's not a workshop to do. We just get to have conversations.
And I generally
kind of stumbled into motivational interviewing and its complexity during my fellowship in health psychology. So I
wait, this sounds like your why. Is this your why?
There's so many different ways that the why can happen.
Well, let me introduce it real quick. So our theme this season is, what is your why? Like kind of your origin story, your backstory, or, I don't know, your villain origin story, or your hero origin story.
Mm-hmm.
And really because we want to remind everybody and ourselves that, you know, we have whys, and they're not always the straightest paths to get to where we are. But sometimes when things get challenging, it's nice to remind ourselves, what is our why? Like, why are we doing this? What did we get into this? And so we've been asking everybody that's been on the show, like, what is your why? So I apologize if that's not where you were going. It sounded like you were going there, but like, tell us your why. Why do you do what you do?
Well, it's an interesting convergence of time because 10 years ago is when I graduated from Texas Tech with a PhD in counseling psychology, like this month.
Oh, wow.
Happy anniversary. Thanks. It's been a decade. So it's, you know, once you start to look back, you reflect on like, you know, why and how. And
totally.
It's amazing, like the amount of time that's gone by. So I started on this journey even before that, I think I always enjoyed listening to people and connecting with them. I realized very early on in my life that if I shut my mouth and opened my ears, that I was let into people's worlds and they shared with me. Mm. And it mattered. There was something that mattered about it. So I think I just kind of stumbled into psychology. I did all of the socially appropriate things as a kid, where the adults would be like, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I was like, "A doctor. I want to be a doctor." And they got all excited. And I was like, "Okay, maybe I should be that."
That must be the right answer.
That must be the right answer. So I've always been looking for the right answers. And I'm endlessly curious, and I really do like education and learning and figuring things out. But maybe the why story related a bit more to motivational interviewing, or at least kind of what we're going to talk about today with the idea of we have to feel like we have to fix everything. So shortly after I arrived at Texas Tech, I had done a master's before, like a terminal master's, in health psychology at Texas State. And so because of that, they let me do clinical care earlier. And there was this opening as a counselor at the University Cancer Center. And so what this basically was an integrated care setting where you would go around with the whole medical team. You would introduce yourself as, like, "I'm one of the counselors at the cancer center," to all of the patients, the new patients as they were coming in. And I was terrified of talking to people. But more than that, like, this was no place where I had any of the answers. Mm. There's nothing I could tell them to do. Like, there was nothing to fix. There was only this opportunity to listen and to be with people in some of the most difficult times in their lives. And I quickly realized how challenging that was, and how much there were so many different parts of me that were withdrawing from that and feeling like a bit overwhelmed.
Like the uncomfortableness of that?
Right, yeah. Right. The sheer discomfort of, I got in this profession because I wanted to help people, and there was nothing that I knew that was like concrete that could help. And so I became obsessed with this idea of, how is just being with people, how is listening deeply, how is this connection and communication, how does that lead to helping and change? And so I spent a lot of time doing that when I was in graduate school, and then promptly threw all of that out of the window and joined the Air Force. Where
we fix everything.
Right, exactly. Where we figure out like what it is that we need to do, and then we do it, right? So yeah, that I also went through, some of you listening may remember, there were a lot of disparities in numbers in terms of internships and match for APA. And APIC processes a long time ago. And that was when I was going through this process. So I looked at things that I wouldn't have necessarily looked at. And the Air Force was one of them. And I realized health psychology was something that the Air Force does particularly well.
Really well.
All of the famous health psychologists, all of these books were written by these people that were current or former Air Force psychologists. So I was like, okay, maybe these are my people. Like, maybe this is kind of where I need to go. So I started, I applied and was obtained my commission through the match process, and matched at Andrews Air Force Base, and
which is the best internship site, clearly, because it produced both of us, Abby. That's funny. I never knew that. Your origin story is similar, a little similar in that regard. Like, I was so wowed by their health psych program, mm-hmm. but by their primary care initiatives too. So
yes.
That was a huge piece for me. But anyway, okay. So And motivational interviewing fell into that origin story where? Like, is that kind of the fit you felt like for this curiosity and quest for deeper listening that communication style fit with that?
It definitely does fit with it now, I realize it. But at the time I was really, I need to get good at basic counseling skills. Motivational interviewing was one of them, but I didn't kind of fully lean into motivational interviewing until I worked in the Air Force in primary care settings. And then during the health psychology fellowship, we were doing group supervision for motivational interviewing for the fellows. And I brought my first recording, which is very vulnerable to be recording yourself and then bringing it in. And I was so excited because I was like, I think I did a great job with this patient. I was really listening and I was with her and I play it. And then the supervisor was like, you know, Abby, you really connected with her. It's clear that you care, that she likes you, but that's not motivational interfering. I
Crushed.
was like, oh my God. So what I tend to do, the opposite. So other people would be like, okay, maybe I should focus on something else. I doubled down.
Nice.
I was like, I am gonna get good at this.
I
And
love it.
so I s started reading, went to an excessive amount of workshops. And then I was
This
like,
does
okay,
not
like,
surprise me from
no,
what I know of you.
knowing me, like, because the second that someone's like, you're not so good at that, I'm like, I'll show you. I also had an ex-boyfriend that told me he didn't think I could do the Air Force PT stuff. So I was like,
Oh, here we go. Nice.
and now I get a 90 or above every single year.
That's
Anyway,
awesome.
that's why I
So it
say.
sounds like that's one way that we can help motivate you is we can tell you can't do it.
Yeah. No,
Yeah,
you can't.
exactly. Oh my
So
gosh. Okay.
the MI, well, and I want to make sure we get I think the topic we're talking about today is so interesting. So I want to make sure we have time to talk about it. So clearly you kind of kept down that MI rabbit hole and you know, the health psych thing set you up and the primary care thing and all that stuff. And I love the beginning when you were talking about that work in oncology and the humble, maybe how humbled you were in that setting. But we've already sort of alluded to this write it or fix it culture that, you know, that as behavioral health providers, we're sort of in the business, or we feel like maybe we're in the business of fixing things, helping people fix things, helping people, you know, get rid of depression, get rid of anxiety, which is obviously not true, as
Be
we know,
happy all the
behavioral, you
time.
know, as
Don't
good
be human.
providers, right?
Right.
But like, can you talk a little bit about like what is this fix it culture that we're addressing today? And just so that we're all on the same page and our listeners are kind of with us.
For me, the fix it culture really is this tendency where we want to find the problem and then immediately offer the solution and move to the next thing. Right. So I'm like a problem detector, and then I need to have like the best like tool to then like eradicate it. And you know, so this idea that we want a quick fix. So you know, I want a med that will get rid of my sadness. There's something there's this idea in our culture, I think, that there's something fundamentally wrong with us if we feel bad. And everything around us is designed to help us not feel bad.
And we have to get
So,
as quickly as we can back to not feeling bad.
exactly. And it's like there's not even necessarily a balance with it. It's like do whatever is going to most quickly get you to good. And I think it is cultural, right? So a lot of where, you know, I grew up in the state of Texas, and in a very conservative family where if you felt anything, it was like, here's a cookie, like, or don't feel that, or oh, don't say that. It was all very well-meaning. And then I get into a profession where we're trained to find the problem, put them in the right category, and then give them a medicine that they're better. And we define better by not ever feeling bad.
Yeah.
And I see this a lot when teaching and training and even clinically with students where they're like, but they're crying or they're upset. And I'm like, good. They feel safe enough to be human in front of you.
Right.
And they're distressed that they're like, well, how do I stop this? I was like, you can't stop someone from being human. Your job is to allow them space to be human. And tying it into oncology, that's really what that taught me. And I've had to learn that lesson over and over and over again. It's not something that I've easily remembered because we get in these clinical environments that are saying diagnose, provide the research supported treatment, and then move on to the next. And it's not always conducive to the thing that I think is the key healing process in therapy, which is showing up, being real, connecting, listening, and not immediately trying to be like, there's something wrong with you. And it needs to go away.
It makes so much sense to me too, because I think about the times when I'm personally feeling distressed, when I'm not feeling good, right? And I'm maybe even in that fix it mode for myself too. Like I'm doing whatever I can to not feel that way. And I make the worst decisions when I'm in that mode. You know, like those are not the times where I'm at my A game or I'm doing things that are actually healthy or useful. It's like I'm choosing just the fastest and usually worst way. And it doesn't actually fix the problem anyway, right? It just either delays it or distracts or something. And there's something really powerful about, like, you don't have to push it away. You can sit in that discomfort, as uncomfortable as it is. You know, you can sit in it for a while. And there's something very useful and very powerful about acknowledging that.
Well, and I know you're
more functional long term, of course. Mm-hmm.
Abby, I know you're also trained in ACT, and it sort of feels like a crossroads between MI and ACT, or you know how those two actually can work really well together. So what happens, I guess, when you learn not to allow that fix it reflex to kick in? What happens clinically? Like what do you, when you talk to students about this, about the possibilities that open up when you don't, because I think, you know, it is kind of counterintuitive. Like somebody's coming to you because they feel bad. They don't want to feel bad anymore. And your job is to help them not feel bad. And then you're going to not fix it, you know? So maybe say a little about that.
Yeah. It's hard. I love this question. And it's hard for me to describe in some ways, because it's like this, almost this visceral somatic magic where it's when I take a breath and I slow down and I say something like, you're really struggling, this is a challenge, and like let that land, it's almost like it happens and you can feel through it rather than spending all the time just like beating it up and pushing it and pulling it. It's like that part of them can be like, oh, someone hears me. And it's not like yelling and screaming for attention. So I think, you know, in a motivational interviewing sense, we often think if I just tell people just don't know. They just need to know.
Right, you're laughing. It's a deficit of information.
Just stop smoking. It's just not good
just
for you.
Just tell them. This is just not good for you. So you just think like, well, they just must not know, right? And they need my life advice. They don't need my life advice. They're usually sitting there in their own head being like, this. So I, you know, I don't always have the best language, so I'm like trying to.
We'll bleep that part out for listeners.
Trying to stop myself from my usual diatribe.
That's a frustrating thing to experience as a person who's come to talk about what's going on for them, to be kind of talked at, told what their problem
exactly,
is.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So they're being told like about their own life, rather than asked curiously, about what's going on for them. And there's a fear for providers that if I ask a question like that, then we'll just go on and go on. And it's just not true, right? Mm-hmm. The more that you try to fight it, the more that you try to suppress that part, the more it's going to try to come up. And if you acknowledge it and allow it and reflect it, then it isn't trying to knock down the door to be heard anymore.
So let me ask you a question I think might be channeling, maybe it's just me, but other providers too, like, and maybe some of your students have felt this way. Many of us, hopefully, I'm hoping I'm not all by myself. I'll have to admit that there are times where I've had a small private practice in the past, and it's a struggle because, you know, I mean, I was only on one insurance panel. It was mostly self-pay. And I even struggled with the idea that talking to me was worth the amount that I was charging, right? But it was pretty commiserate with what everybody else was charging. And
Kevin
then
just lost all his customers.
I did,
his
seriously.
Customer base
well,
a good thing to zero.
Well, and that's the nature of my question, though. Like, I know there are times I've been sitting in a session wanting to sit with somebody's discomfort, and then I'm like, they're going to wonder what in the world they're paying me for if I just keep reflecting back to them and we're not fixing it. And, you know, while at the same time, I also have the other voice in my head saying, no, that's not your job to fix it. But I'm like, gosh, but I'm charging them a bunch of money to just reflect back what they're saying. You know, how might you respond to that?
Part of this is I am as real with the people that I'm helping as I am with y'all. Very genuine. And I will actually acknowledge things like that and say, you know, kind of say just that. There's a part of me that wants to fix, that wants to kind of give you the quick answer. And then there's also another part of me that knows that this needs a little bit of space, and you have your own inner wisdom. And so I'll be honest about that, and genuine and real with them about the things that I'm noticing, and how much I do want to maybe help. But then I know, like, I will actually say, I've said to some of my clients, like, I could tell you the answer, but you're not going to believe me anyway. Like, so it's like, it's better that we kind of collaborate on this together, or I'll even acknowledge that I'll, like, there's a part of you that, like, wants to know exactly what I think about this, or wants to tell you how to solve the problem. I can tell you some of my ideas, and I'm willing to do that, but I also know that might not be enough to kind of get you where you want to go. Because really, I don't know, maybe I'm just an awful therapist, but I have told people, like, I know I used to tell people what to do, and no one would ever do it. So it could just be an Abby problem. But
that's why I asked the question. I think that I think all of us, at least at some point in our careers, struggle with that idea that I need to be useful and I need to be worth the money that, you know, these people are paying me. But the irony is that the most value for the money they're paying you is to maybe, you know, bear witness to that and sit with them in that discomfort.
So what this makes me think of is I have a lot of therapist friends, which should surprise y'all very much. but we sit around and talk to one of my friends about this, that even in our personal life, there's often not human beings that are willing to sit with us in the ugliness.
Gosh, yes.
So true.
In the mess, in the muck, and be with us in the crap and still come back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To being with us. And so it's priceless that they're paying you funds and that you're sitting with them, because my friend jokes, like, she's like, if you can count on one hand the number of human beings that you can be real with, that you can be messy with, that you can be genuine with, and you'll still keep coming back and they're still in your life, you are so lucky. So lucky. If you can count them on two hands, you're lying. I don't believe you.
That's funny.
Right.
That's so true. I mean, and I think that's so true. And if that was working, right? Like if this person went to the humans in their life and sort of talked about where they were and how in their muck, and their people around them just sat there with them, mm-hmm. they don't. They immediately say, yes, but, or at least you don't. Or, I mean, I know Brené Brown has a brilliant little cartoon clip about that, mm-hmm. or a little video, but it's so rare. Like, our human condition just isn't comfortable when somebody else is uncomfortable, or, and it probably had a, you know, served a purpose mm-hmm. at some point in our lives, but it doesn't anymore. So mm-hmm. I love that reframe of the value. Like, we bring so much value to a clinical relationship when we just do that. And as you know, we've had many conversations about this. Kevin and I are both prolonged exposure therapists. We're big fans mm-hmm. of exposure. But this really is kind of an exposure too, right? Like, this hard thing is going on, and mm-hmm. you keep trying to, you know, avoid it or push it away. And like, we're just going to sit with it. And then you can kind of move on to some other things you might want to do, but like, it needs its time. It needs its space. It needs its voice.
You can't skip to the end of healing.
Yeah.
And nothing can change unless you are aware of it.
Right.
Zero can change.
And not me aware of it as your therapist, you aware of it as the right. human. Yeah.
Right. And needing to acknowledge it and for you to say it, right? There's so much kind of within power. Therapy that's this like, yeah, power, like I know better than you about your life.
Yeah.
Just in healthcare. It makes me crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. Like, are you really? I know more about you than you. Like, you're in your skin. Like, it is a privilege that you're letting me inside your life, and that you're sharing something with me, and that you're willing to disclose that. And then we somehow think that we understand your inner world better than you do. Mm. So part of why I like motivational interviewing so much is that it really does focus on coming to understand someone's inner world about change in a way that is not telling them who they are, not putting them kind of in this box, but allowing them for that space and that opportunity to, you know, to be who they are.
So I'm recognizing that we're far into this episode, and we usually try to keep our episodes to like 25-30 minutes, but I gotta ask you, like, you know, you, with the work that you've done in oncology and work with in other situations too, with various kinds of clients and folks, and maybe even not even in professional practice, could you like tell us a story about, you know, just that, like sitting with somebody in their discomfort and how that went? And of course, not asking you to reveal confidences or that, but mm-hmm. something to illustrate that for folks that are listening.
Yeah. So I mentioned that I work in oncology setting, and sometimes I'm asked to go and just introduce myself when someone is inpatient so that they can know how to like connect with me when they're out of the hospital. And I walked into someone's room, and her family was there, but they agreed to like go and leave. I introduced myself, I said who I was, and I said, I'm here. To make sure you know that we have these support services. I'm here to listen. And it was complete silence. Like, the look on her face was like, why are you, of course I'm struggling with this. Like, why are you, I could feel the anger, and I could feel it in my body. Like, I was like sweating. Like, I'm even feeling it now. It was so uncomfortable. I was like, oh my God. But then I started thinking how much more uncomfortable she is, and that this is my job. This is what I'm teaching and training to do. I'm talking to my students about this. And I took a breath, and I stayed, and I said, you know, is there anything that you're struggling with right now that you'd like to talk about? Again, just kind of like this silent look at me, like, why are you even asking me this? Like, isn't it obvious? Like, what's going on? Like, kind of how close in terms of like her own health and how bad things were. Like, I don't even think I knew how bad things were, like, walking into it. And I, you know, stayed for a little bit longer, Tried to understand a little bit about just like who she was as a person and listen, and left my information. And I never thought I would hear from her again. Like I was like, that was awful. That was terrible. I mean, this was recent. This was recent. This wasn't like when I was a student. Like this was like within the
this
last
morning.
Like,
this morning.
Yeah. So this is a you know, fully formed, you know, person and a, you know, fully baked psychologist. And I left. I was like, she's never gonna reach out, like ever. A couple months later, I get a call from her. And she was like, I'm ready to talk now. I don't think that ever would have happened if I hadn't like looked her in the eyeballs with all of the things that she was feeling and not run out of the room.
Right.
And I didn't do anything, didn't do anything magical. I didn't have a right thing that I said or didn't say.
You didn't hand her a pamphlet of behavior activation things she could be doing, right?
Oh God, no! That would have
right.
really gone.
But that's
great.
A tendency, right? Well, then I'll give you this. Here's a relaxation handout, right? Like,
no.
I love this story, Abby.
I gave nothing but my contact information, and I said, "Reach out to me if you ever need anything."
You
I'm
saw
here.
The human in the room.
Right. Yeah. And I'm so grateful that I have had the experiences in my life where I was able to do that and to be that for someone when everyone else is like running away, wanting to cut it out, wanting to give her more chemicals to kill things. And I was just like, I'm here. I'm here.
Well, and I think that's a beautiful segue into the last part of what we talk about, which is actionable intel. And this has to just be part one, Abby, because I've got like 50,000 more things I want to talk about with you. But given that we know people have things to do, and we need to kind of keep within our timelines, but we like to really end with if you could kind of share. And this is not fixing it, but if you could share with providers, like things, actionable intel, mm-hmm. things they could sort of take forward in their practice, think about things they can incorporate or learn more about or resources. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of heard a couple from you already. Like I jotted down the first one a little irreverently, but you said, shut your mouth and open your ears. And I think that's a really good actionable intel. As much as we're trained to do that, we get going and we kind of forget that. And Kevin kind of was noting another one, which is your job is to allow people to be human.
And what I love about that is that this show is about evidence-based psychotherapies, and we can get so bogged down in procedures and steps and interventions that we sometimes forget that our job, our main job, is to provide a space for people to be human. And you said it so beautifully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So besides those, shut your mouth and listen, and your job is to allow them to be human. What, you know, any other thoughts about like, what could providers kind of take, or what could our listeners, who I tend to call providers, but our listeners, you know, places they could go if they're interested more in terms of MI or oncology work, or just sort of some of the things that you've made sure to foot stomp with students to kind of grow this skill of checking that writing, that fix it reflex.
Thank you for that question. And you know me so well because you already kind of summarized like half of what I was going to say. I would, you know, in terms of the one clear actionable item, this is what I foot stomp with every single student is before you go into a conversation with someone, take a breath. And say for the first 5 minutes of this conversation, I'm going to listen to understand. I'm not going to listen to fix or diagnose or solve. I'm going to listen to understand and do that for 5 minutes and see what happens. Because it allows for cultural flexibility in what that means, listening to understand. And it also gives you permission to do something for a short period of time and then go back to whatever you were going to do anyway. So it's like, you know,
You have nothing to lose.
You can't go wrong. Like, it's
Right, right.
nothing bad could happen. So I always have students like take a breath, center themselves, and say 5 minutes, and they'll listen to understand. If people want to learn more about motivational interviewing, I would say give some really amazing workshops with the CDP colleagues, so which are constantly get waitlisted.
We will be linking those in the show notes, so you can sign up for one coming up soon.
So I would say learn more about motivational interviewing. There's a new edition of the motivational interviewing text that came out in 2023 at the end of that year. Dr. Miller and Rolnick. The fourth edition actually is about helping people change and grow. So the title has even changed. That we're not just talking about like a discrete behavior change. We're talking about human growth and personal development. And so that's really exciting. If you want to watch something with a partner, a friend, a family member about the fix it reflex personified, the it's not about the nail video would be so great for people to show. And that's like a really fun, actionable type of thing where, you know, it's like you're seeing it in real time and people have a visceral, like funny reaction to it. And so bringing a little humor, a little lightheartedness to this can be kind of fun. So even, you know, if you want to be a better human with the other humans that you interact with, it could be fun to show them that and like talk about it.
And we'll definitely link that in the show notes. I think it's Jason Headley. So he's brilliant and lovely and a nice human. So we will make sure we, you know, go check it out on his website. He does great work.
He does.
Okay. So I love those. We will list those, but I think that's a fantastic recommendation. And I'm kind of sad I'm not currently doing clinical work to listen to understand, take a breath and spend 5 minutes to listen.
You can
to
listen
to
me to understand.
I'll practice with Kevin because pretty much every day is a therapy session.
Right.
Don't get paid enough. Anyway. Abby, we
I love you both so much. Thank
we
you.
Love you.
This has been awesome.
We hope this is just the first time we connect on Practical for Your Practice. And for you listeners, again, we're always so grateful that you joined us today. We hope you join us for future episodes. A reminder that we are just dying to hear from you. We will link the speak pipe in the show notes as well. If you have a question, you have a topic you'd love us to talk about, please reach out. And Kevin, you did a great job today, so make sure
thank
you,
you.
Kudos to, you're welcome.
I
Abby, every once in a while you got to do that. So thank you, Abby, for your time, for being a great colleague to us, and
thank you for being here.
This was really fun.
It's my pleasure.
All right,
hope thanks everybody for listening.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
Please feel free to subscribe, like, and share.
Until next time.